Jesus' words about the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith, with the law, the prophets, and the writings. And I spent most of the time talking about the fact that the law was about justice, and the prophets were about God's mercy and bringing the people back to God. And I didn't spend any time talking about the writings. And I suggested that because of comments in the New Testament that Jesus fulfilled the law and the prophets, that it becomes up to us to fulfill the writings. And what I wanted to do today is just look at the writings, because it's all about what we were just talking about here. I mean, it's about raising your kids, it's about living life, it's about death, it's about all kinds of things. And I thought maybe just this afternoon we could just spend a little time just looking at a summary of each of the books that are the writings, because I think what's in the writings is really about us living life. I mean, that's what it is.
Walking in faith.
Right, it's walking in faith.
I think it's a good idea, but do you mind if I ask a question?
No.
Morally, really directed to Carol. We have, it seems inevitable, it seems almost every time that someone, especially a boy, a young boy takes his life, I've said before, and I think some statistics prove it, is that it's because he had a girlfriend and they split. I mean, not every time, but there seems to be that connection. But then Michelle and I were talking about that, and we were thinking, I'm not saying this is the case with Ryan or any, but that it's not necessarily just having a girlfriend and they split. It's that they broke a law, you know, where they had some sexual activity. And because of that, it's such a bond and strength that if they split, it is really hard to take for a person who's not mature enough to handle that, that they, it hurts them. And I'm wondering from your studies, you know, you did studies in counseling and stuff, if there's an equation with that, or is it just sort of a blind theory that not necessarily just having a girlfriend or boyfriend, it's going beyond what's reserved for a marriage relationship, taking that and then tearing it up.
I can't, you know, think of any statistics or studies that show, you know, statistics on that aspect of it, that how often that's an issue. But one of the things, the two things that come to mind when I think about that, one is that, you know, males and females tend to have different biological reactions and responses,
right,
to intimate relationships. And a lot of times we don't give guys the freedom to be able to express and demonstrate when they have that super strong connection. And when it happens, when we're immature and young and not ready and not going toward marriage, it's at a time when the developmental phase is, who am I? And when who am I gets so caught up in another person, because this has been delayed and delayed and delayed, and, you know, now it used to be, you know, in early teens, it's the who am I, in the late teens, early 20s, then you're moving out into developing your core group and your intimate relationships, you're getting married, you're starting a career. Well, now that's getting pushed back later. So the who am I is going on longer too. And when you get caught up in a really intense relationship, when you're still in the who am I phase, that's exactly what happens. When it breaks up, it doesn't just leave you feeling empty because of that loss of relationship. It leaves you feeling empty because part of who you thought you were just got ripped away. And yeah, it's really devastating. And I think a lot of times young men haven't been modeled how to acknowledge their feelings, to understand, to be self-reflective enough to know what's going on with them, to have somebody to talk to openly about it.
But sometimes that simply comes with age and maturity, too.
Well, true, it comes with age and maturity, but it also could come through it being modeled in families, and I don't think it is.
Well, you know? The reason I asked is you mentioned writing, because many of the things that are written there are like, don't do this, don't do that, and we don't really know the reason. Well, we've done some studies on certain things, but when you look back, God knew that if you do things prematurely, it'll hurt you. But we, you know, that's some stupid book in the old day. How would they know that? But God, in His wisdom, had said, if you do this, it's like when He says, divorce is like violence, it rends you. That doesn't mean He doesn't forgive us and mercy if we do through it, but He knows what goes through. And I'm just asking that in general, because every time I hear a story like this, the first thing I always ask is, did he break up with her girlfriend? I mean, that's really what I asked.
That's what I was wondering myself, because I had a guy that I was dating for, we were together for 4 years, going on 5, and we basically lived like a married couple, and when he decided that he wanted to go and see what else was out there in the world, it felt almost like a divorce, and I felt like an empty shell after, and I think someone who wasn't necessarily as strong as I was and had a faith like I did, I know that they probably would have taken their life, and I'm sure I would have had I not had the faith that I knew that life goes on and God has a purpose in my life.
Yeah, and it's so hard because when you're taking your own life, you're choosing physically a permanent solution to what is a temporary challenge, because you do go on. It is possible to go on. You don't have the resources. You don't have the internal resources to know how to do that, or the external resource that you can lean on until you discover that. That's really...
Anyway, thank you. I was just trying to say that because it's just devastating. Every time I hear it, I go,
yeah.
Why?
And people don't, and I don't think we take seriously enough, because like you said, oh, that's an old book. It doesn't have anything to do with us now. Well, I think that because it's languaged such as we have a God out there giving us rules that we must live by or be punished, we miss the fact, I think people miss the fact, because that, you know, it feels so shaming, and a lot of religions have misused that so much that we miss the fact that you can let go of the shame, you can take away the don't do this or God will punish you, and just simply be aware. You know, if I drop this, if I let go, it falls. And God didn't have to say, okay, Carol, let go of that, make it fall. And if I make a choice, depending on what's in my heart when I make it, that's what comes back to me. And God doesn't have to say, oh, Carol decided that, then I'm going to make this happen. No, it's just as much a law, a reality, a principle. Whatever we press forward with from our hearts comes back. And if we're pressing forward with this need for somebody else to make us complete, what we're saying is, I'm not complete, and if that gets ripped away, then it's devastating.
Yeah.
I got something.
I was going to say, that's definitely how my relationship with that guy was. He was my world, and I had planned my whole life around him, and I'm very thankful that that happened, because I was living in the world and obviously doing things I wasn't supposed to be doing, and because of that situation, that's what woke me up and brought me back to God. And I realized that that lifestyle wasn't appropriate. But yeah, that person became like my God, almost. And when somebody becomes that important to you, and then you develop, your life is their life, and vice versa.
Without the commitment.
Without the commitment. And I assumed that he felt the same way I did. He said he did, but eventually that became a lie. That once that's taken away, it's like, who am I? What is my life? What's the direction that's going to go now? Because I had planned my life in a certain direction.
And my house, I've designed that house. It was my... It all came here, you know. I laid out the site plan. I drew where the pond was going to be. I drew the pole barn. I drew the house. I drew the blueprints. I laid the foundation. I laid every stick in that thing. I put the windows in, the doors. I know every flaw in that house. I know that more intimately than any person in the world, because I laid that foundation with my hands. I built it with my hands. And God's the same way with us. He laid our foundation. He built the world. He built us. He created us. He knows us better than we know ourselves. And what he's written in that book really explains who we are and why we are here, and our connection with the world and with God. And when I hear people say, well, that book is dated, it doesn't mean anything, God understands us yesterday, and he understands us today. And no psychiatrist or psychologist or scientist, or I don't care what the science, the field is, it doesn't matter, because they weren't there when he laid that foundation. They weren't there when he created the world. God knows us more intimately than any scientist ever born or ever will be born. And so that book is just as timely today as it was back then.
And, you know, it may be the language, it may be the, you know, particular translation may set people off, but when you start looking, the problems with it are us and the way we read it, mm-hmm. you know, because...
Yeah, exactly.
And honestly,
it's our misrepresentation, our misunderstanding of what God's saying.
Whatever psychologist or yeah. psychiatrist or scientist or anything that's discovered or learned by them, to me, is God revealing God's self to us.
I love it when science advances and they find out that, you know what, the Bible was right. For example, I don't claim to be a scientist. I don't understand the science, but I know the latest findings in science is that there was nothing in the universe, and within a fraction of a second, like a 50,000th of a second, we went from nothing to everything. Now, I don't understand the science behind it. I don't understand how this could be. But this is the latest scientific finding. And what's it say in the Bible? There was nothing but darkness in the beginning. There's darkness upon the face of the deep. And God said, let there be light. And boom, there was light. Everything existed. And scientists now know this is true. But it took all this time for them to figure that out. And I'm like, you know, the more they find out, like, for example, the creation of life itself, they're finding out now through science that what they thought was a simple... form of life, like a worm, the single cell, was just like a basic thing. It was nothing. And now they're finding out through science that this thing is actually extremely complex and intricate, mm-hmm. and there's all these different elements that make up this cell, and if you remove any of them, the cell doesn't exist. The cell can't exist unless all these things coexist right. together. So therefore, and the same thing with the DNA molecule, you know, they know now that this is actually a computer. That this thing is intricately complex, and that this could not have just happened. Of course, this can't be taught in school.
Well, it's interesting, though, because, you know, when the Big Bang Theory was first put forth, it was scientists that didn't like the idea. Because, okay, if it just exploded out of nothing, that speaks of something that was there
yeah.
before, or an intention or something, you know. And
the science only likes to, if they can prove it in a laboratory. And the problem with God is there's lots of evidence of the existence of God, but they can't prove it in a laboratory. So science doesn't like to believe in God because they can't replicate it. They can't, you know, it's not something you can touch. But there are a lot of things that scientists can't prove or they don't understand that are everyday part of life, like life itself. Where did life, you know, they can't explain life, but we're here.
Well, I think, too, that sometimes one of the issues that I think people run into is that we have an idea about God, and we think we know something about God. What we know is this such a minuscule
mm-hmm.
bit of what God, what we call God, really is. And to... people trying to, they take things they learn in science and use it as proof of God. People think they're using it as proof of that little God, when God isn't this, God is much more. And, you know, if we can open, I feel like if I can really open my limits about God, I probably see proof all the time.
I like to use the example of the apple. You know, that one to me just really speaks volumes into the existence of intelligent design. Because, you know, here's this thing. It starts out as a flower. which is brightly colored, sweet smelling. It's designed to attract attention from something, okay? A small something, because it has to be an insect small enough to crawl inside that flower and pollinate that flower. And from that, the seed grows on the tree, and it becomes an apple. And then the apple itself, brightly colored, sweet smelling. And again, there's a beneficial thing going on here in that it understands that some much larger creature has to come along and pluck that apple either off the ground or from the tree and walk off with it to spread its seed. The tree benefits in every step of the process, but in every step of the process, it has to somehow understand, has to have the intelligence behind it to understand there's going to be some foreign body coming along and helping it along this process. And the idea, to me, that this is something that could just happen by chance takes a lot more faith than to believe that somebody come along and designed this.
Well, even the discussion about the evolutionary process is changing so much, because now they're saying, oh, well, all this evidence really is indicating that it's not slow and steady. It's a very punctuated process. Punctuated equilibrium. It's like, oh, something came along and made an adjustment. And all of a sudden, everything changed in what supposedly, so, and it's not random.
Yeah.
And the principle behind it can no longer be considered the survival of the fittest, but the survival of the fittingest, because only highly collaborative things survived and moved on. So that's definitely an intelligence there, you know, even if you just went straight evolution, that's not what that once was considered to be.
Well, even like life itself, you know, if life has no meaning, then why is it from the smallest molecule up to man, everything has a desire to replicate itself? If there's no point, then what's the point of replication?
Including the designer's desire to replicate himself.
Yeah.
That's why we're all here. And the whole process that we go through is a process of choices. I mean, you talked about choices, and you talked about, what was his name, the Garrison boy?
Ryan.
You know, as clouded as it may have been, it was still a choice. And, you know, Adam and Eve, regardless of the fact that Satan was in the garden and there was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God placed a choice before them. And he did the same thing with ancient Israel. After he describes what are called the blessings and the cursings, he said, okay, now understand, I have placed before you life and death. Choose life. It's about choices. And, you know, I think the point of all of that is that when we make a choice to do the right thing, there's a stronger will involved than just making someone obey.
Mm.
Because obedience doesn't necessarily have to come with a willing heart.
Yeah.
But making the choice does. And in fact, you know, you can look at Jesus' life on earth. Why did he do what he did? I mean, why did he heal people? Why did he commit his life to a ministry that resulted in his death? Was it just because God commanded him to do it? Well, no. He made the choice that he was going to fulfill, you know, the sum total of the law. Love God and love your neighbor greater than yourself. And that he fulfilled the whole idea of, you know, greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his brother. Which, you know, he did it for all of mankind. And that was a choice. It wasn't just because he was commanded. And I think that's what's interesting about the writings. You know, the writings are about, like Dennis said, living by faith, which is what we are to be doing. And every one of the writings, when you look at them, are about people who were living by faith. Sometimes the opposite of that, as an illustration or as a poor example, you know, you hear the the statement, you know, if you can serve as nothing else, at least serve as a poor example. And there are lots of examples of that.
I always thought that was my purpose in life.
But when you read the writings, that's what the writings are about.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because one of the beauties of that is that you don't have to walk around in condemnation. Because no matter what stupid choice you make, unwise choice you make, self-centered choice I make, God can make something worthwhile out of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I have one purpose in this life, and no matter what I do, it can be used to move me toward that purpose. Now, there are more and less painful ways of getting there. But the key is getting there. You know, and I'm always so thankful when someone shares that, you know, they've made choices that didn't serve them well and that created pain. But share it out of, well, and it taught me this, and here's why I'm here now, rather than, you know, beating themselves up and carrying guilt and shame, because there is no reason for guilt and shame. You know, that's all taken care of. And
that's all in the writings.
That's all in the writings, yeah.
We prayed for the Garrison family, and we prayed for Mariah's granddad, and there's been times in here when we've prayed for the country. And in a lot of times, you know, we've prayed for people that have been really in really difficult situations, people that have lost family members, like the Garrisons. Being put in those situations or finding yourself in those situations is part of life. And if you look in the writings, one of the books is the Book of Lamentations. It's a lament. And we've all been in situations that we have lamented. You know, we've lost family members. We've grieved over family members. We've grieved over the nation. We've grieved over situations that have occurred. That's one of the writings. And when you read it, you know, Jeremiah is lamenting over his people, his country. You can read it as God lamenting over his children. It's part of life. It's not a comfortable part of life, but it's a part of life. And it's a part of life where you simply can exercise some faith or gain some faith or learn some faith or be taught some faith. But it's the, you know, the just live by faith.
And when I think of faith, I think of it as the power of the presence of God within us. Because faith moves mountains, it's power, right? It's not just a belief. It is the actual power of God working in us. And I think back to a time when I was really concerned about our kids who made some really challenging choices that brought them to places where they got to find God in a deeper place. When you get broken open, you get to a deeper place in yourself. When you find God in that place, your faith is affected. And it's pretty powerful. But I found that was, you know, there's nothing hits you deeper than your kids. That's where I found God more real than ever, was in that scariest of places. Not because God fixed everything, because he didn't, but because he was there.
It's funny how when we're really down, it's like I remember 9/11, when 9/11 happened, all of a sudden everybody's in church. Everybody's waving American flags, everybody's in church, you know. When you're down, when you're like desperate and destitute, and everybody turns to God. It's unfortunate that somebody turn to God, and then as soon as they're comforted, they forget all about him.
That does happen, and that happened for me a lot in my life. But over time, you know, when you get in those scrapes and stuff enough, the reality and the presence becomes so much a part of you, then you remember it all the time. It's like, you know, that changes over time, I think.
It's the story of the judges, actually.
That's the story of the judges.
Hey, I'm really sorry. Oh, okay. I'm not sorry. I'm really sorry again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, if people go through that sometimes.
We do.
And it's not always so clear cut. You know, you think back on a lot of people that we've known that have gone through a variety of religious experiences, and they get burned. Okay? And what kind of an attitude do they end up with for a while?
Kind of bitter, kind of sarcastic.
Kind of bitter? Yeah. Kind of
cynical.
Sarcastic?
Cynical.
Think of a book in the writings that is that way.
Fine, don't kill him.
But think of one.
I was thinking of Jonah.
Well, but Jonah's a prophet. That's a book of prophecy.
Yeah, sorry. Ecclesiastes. He really goes at it there.
The book of Ecclesiastes is kind of cynical. Now, it really is. I mean, you know, when you read it, if you read just the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, you know, it starts out, the words of the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. And it goes on and on and on.
That sounds like us today, talking about Scripture.
It's kind of bitter.
Yeah.
But when you get to the end of it, you know, he says in chapter 12, verse 1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach, when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, and the clouds return after rain, and the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men stoop, and when the grinders cease because they are few, and those who are looking through the windows grow dim, and when the doors in the streets are closed, and the sound of grinding fades, and the men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint, and when the men are afraid of heights, and of the dangers in the streets, and the almond trees blossoms, and the grasshopper drags himself along, and the desire no longer is stirred, and then man goes to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken and before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel is broken at the well or the dust returns to the ground it came from and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. That's pretty cynical.
Yeah.
And then he says, but not only was the teacher wise, he also imparted knowledge to the people. And he pondered, and he searched out, and he set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, and their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails, given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of the making of many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. There is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. And so eventually, even in his cynicism of just having to deal with life, he comes back. And all of those things that we live through, laments, marriage, the Song of Solomon. You know, you read about this, what's in the Song of Solomon, about raising your kids up in the Book of Psalms, about, you know, teaching your kids in your relationship. You find that in the Book of Proverbs. You read about the things that have happened to us. Maybe not to the extent that it happened to Job. Job had some pretty bad things happen to him. But in the end, it was just life. And he was the friend of God. You know, his friends kind of bailed on him, but God didn't. And, you know, all of those things that occur in the writings are things that we live every day. Even the cynicism and the lament and everything else. And I just find the stories in the writings just really, really fascinating when you think about it in terms of the just living by faith. You read the examples of Esther. That was always, I mean, when I sat in church as a kid and just was bored out of my mind by whoever was speaking, you know, I would read the book of Esther, or I would read the book of Daniel. Because those people were living by faith. You know, Esther was a queen, and she decided that because of the situation of her people, you know, she would stand essentially in harm's way. And it could very well have meant her death. But she did it anyway. You know. And then on the other hand, you find Ruth, who was certainly not a queen. She was an Edomite who married an Israelite who died. She was a widow, and she came, you know, to Israel. And she certainly wasn't a queen. She was essentially homeless, had to go out in the corners of the field to pick grain so that she and her mother-in-law had something to eat. And, you know, she was called, the way we term it, she was not an Israelite. She had been married to an Israelite. She was a, quote-unquote, a Gentile. And she was called and converted in the terms that we would use. And she decided that she was going to follow the God of Israel. And as a result of that, and her faith, you know, she became married to Boaz, very wealthy man, and her grandson or great grandson was King David.
Who was then all the way to Christ.
Right.
So
yeah.
There's in the lineage of Christ.
Well, and it's interesting too, because the key things that come out as what those two women did, and even Daniel, we're not talking about, you know, when we think of obeying God's commandments, you know, we think of Ten Commandments, and for our group, we tend to think Sabbath and holy days and things like that. But what's pointed out and what's highlighted in these books is giving of themselves. Is, you know, Esther put herself on the line for her people. And she was led, I think, by God to do so. And Ruth, you know, she went out there and did what she needed to do to help her mother-in-law. And it's not that, you know, she refused to break this commandment because somebody, it was the inner prompting of the Holy Spirit. It was the inner prompting of God leading them. And the same with Daniel. Where does it say you have to pray this many times a day in full view of the king? No, he had no choice. But to, I mean, how could he not come into presence of God? I mean, that was like food for him. That's why he was doing it. Not to, I'm going to be a witness. No, you know, it was coming from within. And I think that's been one of the biggest challenges over life for me, is learning to hear that voice and respond to it. because that's what I see in the writings. I mean, that's what I saw with Abraham. You know, that's what I see with Abraham. And,
I want to add something to what you said about Esther, because looking back after reading it several times, it was actually Mordecai. She was hesitant, and Mordecai talked to her about the situation. And what he said is kind of, I think, applicable to me and maybe to us too. He said, listen, if you don't reveal yourself for what you are and who you believe, don't think that if this guy, Haman, succeeds, that your life won't be in jeopardy. So essentially, the lesson for me is like, if you're trying to hide being a Christian because you're afraid of persecution, don't think if you don't speak out now that if the people who are getting on Christians succeed, that your life won't be in jeopardy anyway. So you might as well tell the king who you are and ask and throw it in God's mercy. Throw your life in God's mercy, because essentially you have no choice. You either show it now or later when it's too late, or you say, I am a Christian. How does that apply to me? Well, I must confess, in the days I try to sort of stay under the radar, because, you know, I wasn't ashamed of it. It's just, it was more like timid, afraid, maybe. Just, but now I'm thinking, you know, if you don't stand out now, who will? And if you don't fight and argue in a logical way, and how can God help you through this? Because really, they're going to go after us sometime, whether now or in the end. You might as well say, well, let's do it. You know, let's get it on now.
But you know, it's to be willing to stand on whatever at any given moment
is don't be obnoxious.
Brought forth. I'm not particularly willing to stand up and argue about being a Christian, because that means something different for everybody. And I don't really care for the label, to be honest. But that doesn't say anything about my faith, my beliefs, and what I hope my life looks like and my actions. You know, what somebody says means Christian doesn't mean what I want to be a lot of times, you know?
I agree with that. I don't mean to label yourself that, but in your behavior, that they will judge your behavior.
Yeah.
And if they associate with Christian, that's good. Hopefully it's the good things, not the bad things. But not to say, I'm a Christian. I don't like that label. For example, when people say this is Christian music, I don't buy it necessarily until I listen to it and say, you know, I agree that's Christian.
Because yeah, I mean, one of the things about the label of Christianity today is, for the most part, a lot of people that are quote-unquote Christians are just really obnoxious. And frankly, I think that does more.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah.
And I think that does more damage
to the name of Christ.
Because they all
lumped together. What's her name, Brittany? Hmm? The one with the hair.
With the hair. Oh, I don't remember her name.
On TV.
But you know, let me. You've all heard this story in Daniel.
Jan.
The king answered. The decree stands. The king made a decree because his ministers recommended that nobody could pray to anybody else but the Persian king and the Persian god. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who was one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. Now, I suspect that Daniel was not one of the obnoxious ones. Okay. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. Okay.
He liked him.
He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said, "Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." And so the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." Because the king couldn't do it. He had made the law, and he couldn't change it. And obviously they were... Go ahead, Luke.
Wasn't he kind of like roped into making that law too?
He was.
Oh yeah.
They were trying to come up with a way to get rid of Daniel.
They were after Daniel.
Yeah.
Well, if you read that part where it says, "Let me tell you, O king... There are some men around here who it's kind of a sniveling coward that crawls
makes me
from
think
under
of
a rock,
the snake
you know?
Paw from Jungle Book.
And then they rolled a stone over the mouth of the lion's den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. And then the king returned to his palace, and he spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. And at the first light of dawn, the king got up, and he hurried to the lion's den, And when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lion's den?" And Daniel answered.
You know what's interesting about that story is, I think we sometimes, because of lack of faith, is that Daniel didn't get into that. They maneuvered what they wanted, but in the end it was God's desire that came to pass.
Right.
So the lesson is, don't worry of those people trying to put you down or trying to insult you or make you look bad when there's nothing you can do about it. You just serve the living God as Daniel did, and God will take care of it.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of living by faith, right? Because I think we get sometimes all worked up and, well, if we don't do this, we'll do that. We need to live God's way of life, and He will take care of it.
Exactly.
You don't have to mess with these fools, you know. Because that's a pretty big, as you know, the rest of the story.
Sure.
Those guys that connived were the ones that got eaten.
They're the ones that got tossed.
You know, I'm not supposed to cheer when my energy goes down, but that was like very satisfying for a minute.
Well, and I think there's a responsibility we have, not just to God, because that's what He wants us to do, but for everybody else too, because, you know, Jesus made it really clear when He got after the Pharisees that the Pharisees were obedient, you know, and He called them whitened sepulchers. They were just essentially painted graves. They were obedient, but they didn't have a willing heart. They certainly weren't changed in being led by God's Spirit. And He told them that they shut the kingdom in men's faces by requiring what they did. And they weren't living by faith. And I think that's a responsibility that we have, is in part we are required to live by faith so that we don't shut the kingdom in people's faces. Because otherwise, how is God going to witness to some people? He certainly can raise up rocks, and He says He will if He has to. But that's what we're supposed to be doing. Not because that's our career, but it's supposed to be just evidence of the fact that we have God living in us.
Well, I was going to say, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about this before, but, you know, Jesus said the kingdom of God is within you. And I take that to mean that dimension or that dominion of the Spirit is, you know, something we have to enter through an internal process. It's not, you know, it's not over here and it's not over there. Just like Jesus, you're not going to find the kingdom. You're not going to find your connection with God out there. It's through the Holy Spirit here. So if they closed the kingdom in people's faces through their requirements, they were making everything external. They were so focused on externals, they weren't leading people. Like Jesus said, you know, He said, when you pray, go into your closet. And I don't remember what they call it. I know there's Hebrew words for different levels of understanding Scripture. There's the literal, and then there's the... Well, you know, one way of understanding that is that everything in the Bible is about an internal process. You can read it that way. And if you think about that, He's saying, you know, go inside. Don't make your prayers out on the street for everybody to see. Go inside. You know, knock on the door of your own heart and seek the presence of God, and you'll find it. And if you're so caught up in, I have to do this and I have to do that, instead of presence, you miss out on.
Well, I think that's what God meant when He said, you know, having a heart of flesh and having the law written on your heart, because then it's internal and that's what comes out. It's not an external.
That's what comes out. Now, the doing of things can be good, because the doing of things, you know, you repeat something and it brings you into awareness, and your awareness can go deeper and deeper and deeper. I mean, when we keep the holy days and celebrate and think on those things every year, you know, it means something different, deeper, or whatever.
But
yeah, remember Christ said, do those things, but don't let the other things get undone.
Right.
So it's,
yeah.
Oh, we'll only do the physical, only do the spiritual, but, you know, by your, I will show you by faith, by my works. Mm-hmm. So it's both. But one thing I wanted to mention was, as you mentioned about that label of Christian, I think we always, there's a balance. We read the line between being so open about our beliefs that we're obnoxious and people don't want to listen to us anymore because we just are paying, to being embarrassed by what we believe. So there is, and also it's not good, as you mentioned, to be labeled, because labels have meanings that are different to different people. So I think that's kind of, I remember when I first got called, I was telling everybody, they got tired of listening. And now I just learned there's a time to do it. There's a time to stand up, time to just chill and just say, you know.
Let me ask you something, because this is something that's really been kind of in my awareness lately. Do you get any sense, I'm getting the sense that some of the difference is that if in my sharing there is some energy of wanting to convince someone that I'm right, which I do, I have a lot of that.
We all do it.
That's where it goes awry. If it's simply explaining, oh, I do this because it's important to me, or because, you know, I feel like this is, you know, my faith or whatever, is so different than, well, I do it because this says such and such, and it proves that that's wrong, and this, you know, when, I don't know how to explain it, but if I'm coming at it from just, oh, well, I do this because...
Stating facts rather than making a case.
Yeah, making a case. I find myself making a case too often.
Okay.
And that changes everything.
That's interesting, because something happened when I had to go to Jackson this Wednesday because I had a couple of meetings. And previously I told my boss that I can't work because of my church, my belief. I'm going to leave earlier on Friday. This is when it was like close to the Sabbath, at 4:30, and I told him we observe sunset. Just to why, give him the why. He said, that's okay, we get paid by results, not by hourly, which is, I like that, and I don't like that. It depends, you got to get results. Well, anyway, so that was kind of our conversation, and I'd given him a list of like holy days that I observe in the Sabbath. And then, anyway, I was at the meeting ahead of everybody, and he comes in. He looked not very happy at all. And so I said to him something like, I guess your day hasn't been doing good. And he was just cussing away. I mean, I know him, but he wasn't like a bat. It was cussing. And then he said, you know, yeah, you know, maybe I shouldn't be speaking like this in front of you. So he told him. And I never told him I don't cuss, because I don't. But somehow without saying sometimes, they kind of make some connection.
And I think they make more of a connection.
Right, by your behavior.
Right.
Not by what you tell them you do.
Exactly.
Well, that was a great way to put that, Luke. Make a case. Because as soon as you said that, I became aware of the way I feel when I'm doing that. If I'm trying to make a case, why am I making a case? Not just to convince them I'm right. I'm making a case because I want them to approve of my choice. I want their approval. I want to be approved of or liked. That's a big one for me. I mean, that comes up a lot. That's like my prime motivator, you know, for everything.
Approval?
Huh? Approval, yeah.
You don't want to make a comment. I hate being liked. Despise it.
You know, you mentioned that Christian is like almost like a dirty word. It is. It's because you got, you know, I'm going to throw this out there, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but it's true. You've got some of these clowns on TV.
Oh, absolutely.
Who are an embarrassment. And I think, you know, people see this, and they think that this is what Christians are. Or they see these people from Westboro Baptist Church out there carrying their signs saying, God hates bags. And
oh, God
this
hates
is
soldiers.
What, yeah. Or today's news. America. Did you hear the news today?
The cardinal of the Los Angeles diocese just stepped down. He resigned his position because the child abuse cases have gotten so numerous in Los Angeles that he does not know how to handle it. And he finally just stepped down.
And this is what people see, and this is what they right. think when they think Christian. But, you know, we all know Christians. We know that doesn't represent every Christians. I mean, you know, that's like 5%. You know, it's like maybe 10. It doesn't represent the bulk of Christians. The people that I know are all decent, hardworking, down to earth.
But it's not just them.
This is what they see.
But but at some level, because none of us are perfect, we are all that.
Exactly. Christians are just people, like everybody else. Right. But they try to be. Most Christians try to be decent people.
Oh, sure.
And the word Christian
also
is so vague that, like, for example, our president, pick on him because he's an easy target, claims to be a Christian, but yet he accepts all religions, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu. He says there's other paths to Christ or to heaven. You don't need Jesus Christ. That's not a Christian.
Well,
that is a universal spiritualist. It's not a Christian.
Well,
Christian,
then,
when you say Christian,
you are,
it
there's, there's your label.
Very.
So you've got a label.
Yeah, and so
it's got to meet your
definition. But I agree with you what you're saying. It's almost a dirty word. I don't like.
And somebody else may have a different definition. And I know lots of really good meaning, well-meaning people that put people off because they're so stinking self-righteous.
Yeah.
And I've been one, so I know the feeling. I know the words that I've said when I've said it.
You know, you're human. You're like everybody
else.
Well,
yeah, and I'm okay with that.
What I've told people...
That label I'll wear.
Yeah, what I've told people in the past, my grandma's boyfriend loves to attack Christians. He claims to be of the faith, but he hates Christians, he says, because he claims that his whole life they've always attacked him. But I tried to explain to him, well, maybe they were judging you, but, you know, because he's saying they're hypocritical and they're not perfect, so why... And I'm like, you know... True, that they aren't perfect, but at the same time, they're not trying to be judgmental. They're not trying to be judgmental. They're just trying to say to you that perhaps this isn't the best path you should take. But I think most Christians make the mistake they need to say before they start telling somebody this is how you need to live your life. They need to say, I'm not perfect either. However, I think the better path would be for you to choose this way.
Well, and let's face it, some of the reaction to things comes from maybe a sense of, okay, you're doing something different from me, therefore I'm going to assume you think you're better than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, we project. Mm-hmm. We project a lot.
Yeah.
Well, Brittany, I think you hit that key word correctly. The key was hypocrisy. It was a problem in the church. It's a problem at home when the kids see their parents doing something, not because they're fallible, but because they pretend that they're infallible.
Yeah.
That's what... I don't think my kids would be upset with me because I fail, but if I tell them I'm perfect and they see that I'm not, that's what they don't like. And I think that's what it is with Christians, too. They project, they're perfect, they have no problems, you guys are. When people clearly see, they do have problems.
Yeah.
So when you bring up the point that if you say, you know, I know I'm not a good example, and I just hope God has mercy on me, but this path is not the way to go for me or you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's different than saying, hey, look at me. I think that's the part that gets people, the hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anyone will, I don't think, anyway, normal thinking people, reasonable, would say there's anybody that's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, hypocrisy is not living by faith.
No. Pretending,
right?
Yeah.
I like writings of Paul. He always starts out with explaining how he's like a dirt bag. He's always like apologizing. You know,
he does.
And as sinners, I am the worst, or I am the
least.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
And he's always telling people, you know, I'm not perfect. You know,
and
I like that attitude. You know, and that's that humbleness really should, because. As a Christian, I believe all Christians are this way, and I know they're this way, because the Bible says that all sin and fall short. All sin. There is no man that doesn't sin. We all sin, we all fall short, we're all human. We all have same fallibilities, and just because you're a Christian, doesn't all of a sudden, God doesn't come along and say, okay, you're a Christian, wacky, throw some kind of special thing on you, and now you're this magic person that never, you never sin, you never do it, you're perfect. And for people that try to portray that you know, I'm better than you because I'm a Christian and I never sin, people that are trying to, they're no better. I mean, look at Jimmy Swaggart, for example. You know, here he is. I mean, and they all do this. Jim Baker. All these guys on there preaching, you know, you got to live this life, and, you know, they're you know, throwing dispersions on all kinds of people and groups and everything else on TV, and they're themselves, you know, they're having affairs on their wife or whatever, and they get caught. The bottom line is, they're no better than anybody else, but that's really the way it always has been. It's not just them, it's all of us. We're all like that. None of us are perfect. And if Christians would just kind of get off their high horse and say, like Paul, hey, you know, I'm not perfect. I'm a heathen. I'm a dirtbag. I like that. I think it's the centurion, wasn't it, that comes to the church and, you know, that they got this guy. Sadducee. I think he's a Pharisee. Comes in there and he says, look at me, I'm great, I do all these things for you, God, because I'm so perfect. Yeah, and then the other guy, the centurion, comes in, he throws himself on the floor and says, forgive me, God, because I'm a sinner.
Right.
You know, I'm a lowlife, I'm a sinner, forgive me. God favors that guy, because that guy humbled himself, and he admits, you know, I'm not great. Where this other guy's thinking, you know, I'm so much above everybody else. God appreciates and respects the guy who humbles himself. And I think that's the way, if all of us were like that, if, you know, if we didn't have these, I hate to say it, highfalutin Christians, I guess, that are trying to portray themselves as being so much better than everybody else, if they just say, you know what, I'm not perfect.
Well, the thing about what you said,
I try.
What you said, though, it's true, but even if we were all that way, I think what Carol says is also correct, that sometimes people project.
Yeah.
You say, I know with my kids sometimes that happens. I don't think it's a good idea to do that. You don't trust me. You don't think I'm going to go, no. That's not what it is. But people do that. If you say, you know, you shouldn't do that. It's like, you judge me. You think you're better. So even if we did exactly what you just said,
yeah.
I think that the projection, because I do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was another thing that just came to mind that, too, about self-righteousness, is that, you know, because I've been looking at myself and the way I judge other people, and I've judged some people that I really love for being self-righteous. And I realize, you know, self-righteousness, what comes across that way is sometimes, too, just a protective fence that we put around ourselves because we want to walk in faith. We want to do what God wants us to do. And, you know, there might be a little fear about that, and if I'll kind of keep that at a distance, if I let my lips get a little thin when I see somebody do that or, you know, turn my nose up, it keeps it at bay. It keeps me away from it. And I've come to realize that sometimes when people are being self-righteous, it's just a protective measure. It's a defense mechanism. And as they grow deeper in faith, they won't be self-righteous about that, mm-hmm. but they might be self-righteous about this out here as they further their walk. They, we, me. You know, so while I'm judging people about this being self-righteous, I also see that piece of it.
Yeah. Well, Carol, you remember, I think Alec, a group of us had gone to these marriage seminars. What's mm-hmm. it called? Marriage for
Weekend to Remember.
Yeah. One thing that I know Michelle and I have talked a lot about when we compared it to our previous association is when some of the ministers spoke, they never said, like you said, I'm a scumbag. But these guys that spoke, the reason I thought they had me captivated by what they say is because they confessed that they have problems with their wives and they have struggles. And so we kind of identified with it. But those who go up there and never, I'm not saying you air your dirty laundry. I think we know that. There's a limit to that. Mm-hmm. People get tired of the state. Just do that in your own house. But enough to show fallibility that we got to do. I think that helps. I remember Jeff talking about how sometimes he gets to work and he thinks Sharon's the worst person he's ever known, and he knows it's Satan doing it. To acknowledge that we all do that sometimes. We love our wives to death and die for them, our husbands, but sometimes we want to like strangle them for like a second. to know that, hey, you go...
2 seconds.
Yeah, maybe 2. You go through that too, and the people who listen go, you know, yeah, But that doesn't mean we're evil. It means it's human.
Yeah, I find that people open up more when you share your own vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
Like, I have a friend who, she's been having relations with a married man, and instead of coming right out and saying to her, that's something you shouldn't do, I say, you know, this is my past. I'm not perfect. But I advise you to not do that because nothing good will come of it. She's more receptive.
Right. Yeah. And that comes, you know, that kind of approach comes from a more mature understanding of, I think, what God means when he tells us to live by faith. Who was it? New converts tend to be very dogmatic about things. And I think in a lot of our former associations with other groups, you know, we recognize that everything is black and white and right and wrong. And was it Thomas?
Ron Miller.
Ron Miller. We talked about the Buddhists have a saying that the new converts of Buddhism are always referred to as they stink of Buddhism. Because they,
I like that.
You know, it's just out there and it's obnoxious to
so
everybody.
Excited.
And they're so fervent about it, but they just turn everybody off.
They stink of Christianity.
Yeah, yeah. And they stink like of that. Christianity, yeah. too. Yeah.
Well, they also, there's also this similar thing. You know, you could say, and this was about Buddhism, when I became a Buddhist or when I became a Christian, no one liked me. But when I became a Buddha or when I became Christ-like, you know, oh, it was all different then.
Yeah.
So, that response was, I'm sure, a much better response and probably had a more thoughtful consequence than, oh, well, you shouldn't be doing that, you know.
Right.
That makes me think, in the South, I can remember older women having the respect, you know, they'd hear something and they'd be like, well, I never.
Yeah.
And I think now we might, under the right circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think people just, they like that you can, even if you, because obviously I don't know what it's like to have an affair with a married man. I would never cross that path. But the fact that I can find some kind of common ground with her,
mm-hmm.
and say, this is the decisions that I made in the past that affected me in a negative way, and, you know, your life is your life, but if you follow down this path, these are the negative things that could come out of this decision.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do believe, though, lest we lead some of our young people astray, you don't have to have done some bad things to be effective.
Right. No,
right.
No.
You know, it's like, oh,
there's easier ways to get where you need to go.
Yeah.
You got some life experience.
That's the book of Proverbs.
Right.
I mean, it's not go out and do all the bad things
so that
so
you can be a better Christian.
Right. It's an attempt to teach us all that there is a right way and a wrong way and choose life. You know,
you don't
have to do the other thing. It will happen, and people will, but here's a heads up, you know?
I've got a real good friend of mine, Tom Proctor, she knows him. This guy's just, like, solid as a rock, good Christian guy, and I'm sure he's led a lot of people to Christ. I'm sure he's this, but his method is never to really be judgmental and not to beat people over the head with a Bible, but just by his own life and the way he lives his life, and he's like a gentle giant, and he's just like, you know, one of the most solid people that you'd ever meet, and a real man's man, and he just wins people over by just you know, not being a corrosive, abrasive personality, but by being kind and generous and being an example for people to follow.
Well, think about Jesus's ministry.
Yeah,
three. What we read in the Gospels, where was he ever abrasive or in somebody's face?
Only when he turned the tables over.
Well,
only we call them Whited Sepulchre.
Yeah, but who was that to?
Yeah.
Who was that to?
Yeah.
It was to people who should have known better.
Should have known better, yeah.
Well, but he didn't just do it because they should have known better. It was because there was an injustice going on.
That's right.
They were hurting other people,
right,
and damaging their faith because of their behavior.
Well,
and so he was coming,
yes,
mm-hmm, in to set that right.
He actually had this statement, which I enjoy, even though it's not very flattering. You search the whole world for a convert, and when you get them, you make them twice the son of hell.
Yeah.
After you got them. It's like, I don't think that's a compliment.
And the whole deal of turning the tables over, I mean, when you read where that occurred, granted, ancient Israel and Judea at the time was a separate society. Women were not allowed in certain places on the Temple Mount, nor were Gentiles. And the place where he turned the tables over was where they were both allowed, and people were in there acting as money changers and taking up the space where they were allowed to be, keeping them out. And he had none of it. You know, it was like, you guys need to get out of here so that this place is available for the people to come commune with God.
Well, let's discuss what they're doing was wrong, right?
Well, yeah.
You made the house of God a den of thieves.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the same.
Right. Good discussion.
Mm. Yeah, you know, when we think of grace and forgiveness and mercy, my top guy, and if you guys haven't read it, you might want to read it again, is Manasseh. That's the guy's most perverted, evil, murderous. I feel superior to him. I'm hell. But I'm saying that as a fool. You read his life, almost horrible guy. It made Hitler look like,
mm-hmm,
Cupid, you know, I mean, and then God, he asked for forgiveness, and God forgave him. Which means, I know I'm making a judgment here, but if God can forgive someone who's done all that, clearly repented, then God can forgive just about anyone, because this guy was despicable. Idi Amin looked like a charm.
I believe that. I believe God,
if you read Manasseh,
murderers and everything else. You know,
yeah, but if you have you read how what he did? I mean, this guy.
Yeah, it's been a while. I'm trying to reread.
Yeah, Manasseh.
It's been almost 20
years.
Look
up this king, and it was just like, I said, why would you forgive that? I mean, that's of course me speaking. But it gives me hope. Their writings are a lot of fun stuff in it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Examples.
Really, and they're examples that are applicable to everyday life. That's what's so amazing about them. And, you know, just about any situation you can think of, there's something applicable in the writings that's relevant.
Well,
you
I know
what all books are included in
yeah.
the writings. Human nature hasn't changed, so.
In the Jewish inspired order, not necessarily the way we have them, in our modern Bible, they are Psalms, Proverbs, Job, the Song of Solomon, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, and then one book that's made up of what we know as Ezra and Nehemiah, and then one book of what we know as First and Second Chronicles. And those are the writings.
You know, I know this is not the writings, but something we were discussing about having an effect on people around us. You know that admonition from Paul to a woman who does not have a converting husband. He said, by your good behavior,
uh-huh,
they may be called into God's presence. But not by your word, but by your good behavior. It applies to guys too, I'm sure.
Right.
I mean, I think that's summarizes that part of it. Not the talking, it's the living and the doing. I found that that really is more effective. That doesn't mean you can't say something at the appropriate time.
Right.
I think with my kids, I found that too. It's that they remember all the doing things, the saying, kind of. I can think that's normal. Good and bad.
Yeah. Anybody else got any thoughts?
Talking about the winning people over with your good attitude and everything. We're going through the Truth Project, Adult Packet series, in a class. And one of the examples he used when we're going through and talking about just how the nation is going downhill and everything. His son was going through the cabinet and getting out, I think, a glass so he could get a cup of water or something like that. And his dad said, "No, stop, go back. I noticed something." And the kid's like, "I was just getting out a glass of water." "I know, go back. I noticed something." So the kid goes back to the cupboard, opens it, and goes to shut, and his dad's like, "Stop." And he's like, "What?" "I noticed something." So he gets up, goes over to the cupboard, he says, "Have you guys ever tried to do the thing where you try and shut the fridge door and see if the light stays on?" And everyone's nodding their head, "Yeah, we've all done that." And he says, "Well, I noticed that when you open a cabinet door, the entire cabinet is filled with light. But when you shut it, it's all closed." And he goes through the whole explanation of how he kind of set the equation and how this works. And he stepped in the closet, opened it, and then shut it again, trying to see if it was, if light was in there, and then opened it again, and almost as if discovering light for the first time. And he's like, "You know, it works the same way. If there's darkness in an area of anywhere, it's not because somebody opened a box of evil and it just all over the place. It's because the light either is not there or it's been taken away. You know, light can win over darkness, but darkness does not win over light." Mm. And that was really cool, and just the fact how he related something that's so obvious and in front of our face every day that we never even realize. That with this country going downhill and everything, it's not because we have opened up a box of darkness and set it in the country. It's because either we've shut the light out and we've closed the door so the light can't enter, or because God has physically just decided, "Okay, well, you guys have had your chance and you turned away, so I'm going to take the lamp away." You can't win people over or defeat the light in others by pouring darkness out, but you can defeat darkness by light.
Yeah, pouring out light.
I was looking for at some quotes last month, Dr. Martin Luther King quotes, and one of them was, "Darkness can't drive out darkness, only light can do that. And hate
right.
can't drive out hate, only mm-hmm. love can do that."
Smart man.
Yeah.
Very smart man. Yeah, and he's another good example of, you know, somebody who, you know, he could very well have had a book written about him in the writings, you know, like Esther and Daniel. And, you know, he was a pretty interesting, pretty amazing person. Yeah. Anybody got any other thoughts? No?
I'll just blank.
Good.